the name of Allah, the Most Gracious, the Most Merciful. Indeed, we shall avenge the criminals. This is how the leadership of the Iranian Revolution Guard Corps began its official statement on April 14, announcing the beginning of the True Promise operation carried out by the Airspace Force with support from other forces. Operation True Promise consisted of a broad military operation against targets inside occupied Palestinian territories with missiles and drones in response to the numerous crimes of the Zionist regime, including the attack on the consular section of the Iranian embassy in Damascus and the martyrdom of Iranian military commanders and advisors. Chief of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces Major General Mohammad Bagheri detailed the retaliatory attack against targets in the occupied territories, saying that the Israeli regime failed to intercept Iran's projectiles.
The strikes were designed to target a massive intelligence center in Jabal al-Sheikh on the border with Syria. The center relayed information that was used to attack the consular section of the Iranian embassy in the Syrian capital of Damascus. Among the targets was also Israel's Nevatim airbase, from which the regime used its F-35 fighters in the crime committed against Iran's embassy.
Chief Commander of the IRGC, Hossein Salami, gave his assessment of Iran's operation, True Promise, saying if the Zionist regime targets any of our personnel, properties, and civilians, we will not hesitate to retaliate from our land.
The operation could have been executed in much larger scales, but we decided to just focus on the Israeli targets that are used directly against us and our allies in the region. Based on our latest verified reports, the outcome was better than what was expected. I advise the Zionist regime to learn from its mistakes and stop repeating them. The operation helped us gain a lot of information about their defensive measures, and if they retaliate, our next response will be much larger.
Whoever followed the events from their beginning and read the current True Promise developments on the military, political, economic, and social levels reached an inevitable conclusion: the demise of the Zionist entity first, and the disintegration of the global system of evil second. On April 14, there were no gray areas. As direct players, you were either rubbing the nose of Zionists from all capitals of the resistance axis, or you were an abhorrent entity protecting the cancerous, vile Zionist regime who had been involved in incremental genocide since October 7, 2023. And as spectators, you either supported the resistance celebrating the strike on Zionist Israel for Gaza first and foremost, or you were an appeaser and agent rushing to downplay the event, mock it, or call it a theatrical performance. You are either a free human or a tormented, shackled soul that will never taste dignity, glory, and the certainty of victory. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps launched Operation True Promise in response to Zionist Israeli aggressions targeting occupied Palestinian territories with missiles and drones. The operation signifies a resolute stance against the Zionist regime and the broader global system of evil, with supporters celebrating resistance against the Israeli occupation while detractors downplay its significance. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Ibrahim Mousawi, Hezbollah Member of Parliament and Professor of Media Theories and Studies at the Lebanese University. Thanks a million for being with us, Professor Mousawi. Now, many regional normalizers with the Zionist Israeli entity, especially those whose countries actually played a defensive role against the Iranian missiles, which they attempted to intercept while on their way to target Zionist Israel. Many of them downplayed the Iranian response, the True Promise operation, claiming it is just a theatrical performance. On what grounds are these people supporting these claims?
Well, thank you for giving the opportunity. It's a must to say that this is a glorified day. This is a glorious day for all of us, for all of the doomed, oppressed people, for the Palestinians, for the Arabs, for the Muslims, for all who believe in freedom and liberation and independence and in dignity. Indeed, we have to say this as an introduction to what we're going to say. Those who are downplaying or downsizing the achievement, the significant achievement, and I insist the significant achievement by the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Revolutionary Guard against the Israeli existence, against the Israeli entity. They are either one of two cases. They are collaborators with the enemy at one side, or they are people who have this very, if you want to say, complex of inferiority against the West and against Israel. Those who are downsizing this, they have a job. It's either a paid job, or they are trying to waive the excuse, try to tell their excuses, because they have always been inferior to what's coming from the West. Mm-hmm. One, the Islamic Republic of Iran, one Hezbollah, one the Revolutionary Guard, one Hamas, one all of the resistance factions, Islamic Jihad, others, when they take the initiative and fight back after 75 years in order to liberate Palestine, this tells a very important narrative for all of the generations to come, that we are in the position to resist, we are in the position to defeat the Israelis, and we are in the position to defend, and not only to defend, but also to launch. Now, Israel is vulnerable. Israel has no kind of shield. Israel has the Western support, and it has never been tested before. It has never been witnessed.
This is where the upcoming...
It has never been witnessed before that Israel is so open and vulnerable. And very
which, by the way, Dr. Moussaoui, it might put Israel in a position where it can go all ballistic on everyone. This is my question for you, because after what comes after this Iranian retaliation is either just a slap in the face of the Zionist entity, which they take, they swallow, and they sit, or they go ahead and do an uncalculated, if I may, attack against Iranian soil, which would no doubt ignite the entire world, not only the region of West Asia, but the entire world.
Actually,
I'm interested in this second option. How do you see the possibility of that option, especially this week?
Not very likely, actually. It might happen. I don't want to say this cannot happen. I cannot negate or say it's negative 100% that Israel wouldn't do it. But I tell you one simple thing. Now, the United States, Washington has taken the initiative. Washington has the upper hand. Washington has told Israel not to attack back against Iran. Why? Because Washington loves the human rights, because Washington respects the peoples and governments and the sovereignty of states? Of course not. It's because they have made their own calculations and they know what kind of consequences and repercussions might happen. First, this is a very sensitive juncture of time because Biden is on the running for the elections. Second, the United States and the West haven't recovered from the continuous and permanent defeat that is taking place in the Ukrainian war against Russia. Third, they don't want to have any destabilization in the regional order now, especially that Iran has the upper hand. They have to understand they are colonial powers. They came here thousands of miles away in order to exploit our fortunes, in order to colonize our people, in order to make the theft of our oil and of our land and of so different resources in the region. We are the people. We are the indigenous people. We are the owners of the land. We are the owners of the history. We are on the right side of history. And that's why United States don't want to go into this kind of war. If they made, again, if they made this kind of miscalculation, if Netanyahu did it, then we are going to witness unleashing powers. And Iran has made it very clearly, if they do it, they are going to retaliate 10 times than they did now. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that Israel is ready for that. I believe most likely they are going to swallow it. And if not, they want to do any symbolic things just to say that they have done mm-hmm. something back and they didn't swallow it completely.
And it's something that is unprecedented on all levels, not with the Iranian retaliation alone, because during the early hours of Sunday, April 14, Professor, as we as spectators, we all saw that the entire axis of resistance was actually involved in that retaliation in one way or another, but we were not really able to follow everything that was happening because it was immense and in a very short period of time. Can you clarify what was the role of each of those Operation True Promise actors briefly, please?
Well, actually, my understanding is that they were all on high alert, but none of them has interfered. Actually, there is a continuous engagement. For example, take South Lebanon, for example. There is a continuous engagement, and it continued. It didn't stop. But the very important thing is that the people of Gaza, who have been under since like almost 200 days under this continuous barrage of Israeli attacks and the continuous and permanent presence of the drones and the war jets in their air, they were happy because they like have taken a kind of a kind of holiday vacation.
It was calm for the first time in 6 months, wasn't it?
Exactly. This is one thing. The other thing is that the importance of this attack by the Revolutionary Guard in Iran is that it has been done solely by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard. None of the other parties, none of the other sides of the sector has, or the Axis has interfered. Not in Yemen, not in Lebanon, not in... This is very telling. Iran wanted to tell the whole world that it's going to defend its soil by its brave soldiers, by its brave Revolutionary Guard members, by the will and the determination of Iran. This is one thing. But all of those on the Axis, all of the ribs of the Axis, they were ready and they were on high alert to interfere at any time because they are fighting as an Axis and they continue to fight as an Axis.
Mm-hmm. Well, we will continue talking about this in the second half of the show. Now, please stay tuned because next we are going to talk about how this unprecedented slap to the Zionist face will change the face of the region.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Iran's recent unprecedented military operation on Zionist Israel is no doubt a pivotal moment in Middle Eastern geopolitics. It emphasizes the strategic significance of the attack, showcasing Iran's military capabilities and its determination to reshape regional power dynamics. Overall, the attack signifies a turning point in the West Asian hemisphere with far-reaching implications for global perceptions, bolstering Iran's influence among anti-imperialist nations and reinforcing its commitment to the Palestinian cause. More details in the following report.
In recent days, West Asia has been shaken by Iran's bold military retaliatory strike against Zionist Israel, marking a significant turning point in the region's geopolitical landscape. This operation, dubbed the True Promise, was a response to Zionist Israel's aggression on the consular section of the Iranian embassy in Damascus and the martyrdom of Iranian military commanders and advisors. However, this operation has far-reaching implications that extend beyond mere military confrontation. Let's delve deeper into the key points that underscore the significance of this event. Starting with the Zionist-Israeli attempt to downplay the importance of the attack underscores its significance. Contrary to Zionist Israel's narrative, the strike holds immense military and strategic value, showcasing Iran's capabilities and resolve to defend its own interests and its allies in the region. Iran's operation has also ushered in a new era, challenging the traditional power dynamics in West Asia. By successfully executing this retaliatory attack, Iran has established a new equation, signaling to regional actors that it possesses the means and determination to reshape the balance of power. Iran's operation has also bolstered Iran's position in the eyes of anti-imperialist nations and individuals worldwide. Through its decisive response, Iran has demonstrated its commitment to defending oppressed populations and challenging imperialist aggression, thereby garnering support and admiration from like-minded entities, all evident by the exploding social media posts from all across the world as the operation was underway. Iran's strike now serves as a powerful assertion of its unwavering support for the Palestinian cause. By directly targeting the Israeli occupation with a projectile of advanced ballistic and hypersonic missiles, Iran has reaffirmed its commitment to standing alongside the Palestinian people in their struggle for justice and liberation. All of the above could not have been possible had it not been for the Islamic Revolution leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei's decisive leadership in authorizing the retaliatory attack, which has garnered widespread acclaim, both domestically and internationally. His unwavering commitment to defending Iran's interests and confronting aggression has solidified his position as a revered figure in the region and beyond. It is safe to say today that Zionist Israel's decades-long boast of invincibility has been shattered in the wake of Iran's attack. The Zionist regime's inability to prevent or adequately respond to the strike has exposed its vulnerabilities, leading to a decline in its perceived strength and credibility on the global stage. As the dust settles, the ramifications of this historic event will continue to reverberate across the geopolitical landscape, shaping the dynamics of the region for years to come.
Now we are back with Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, Hezbollah Member of Parliament and Professor of Media Theories and Studies at the Lebanese University. Dr. Ibrahim, thanks again. Now, how does Iran's recent operation, True Promise, on Zionist Israel challenge traditional power dynamics in the region of West Asia? And what are the implications of regional stability that the United States of America have been repeating for the past 3 days?
After the 14th of April, now, as we say, there is the 7th of October before and after, we say the 14th of April before and after. Mm-hmm. Now we have a new Iran. Now we have a rejuvenating of the new face of Iran. Iran has ushered in a completely new geopolitical strategic era, not only in the region but in the whole world, because it's telling the whole world that all of your support that you have been funneling to the Israelis through 75 years, they meant nothing. The people in the region wouldn't accept its existence, and they are ready to hit back if the Israelis, if the Americans are continuing their aggressions in the region. This is one thing. The other thing, the geostrategic features and the geostrategic consequences of this attack will unfold on the political level, on the economic level, on the military level, on the strategic level, and we are going to witness little by little how the dynamics, the whole dynamics in the region are going to change. As you can see, there is a kind of dynamism that is accelerating in a very hasty speed in the region, and I believe this is going to continue. Always it will boil down to the interest of the people of the region, to the Islamic Republic, and to the axis of the resistance. This is something that we will all witness little by little, how the influence of Israel will diminish little by little, how the influence of the Israeli, of the American hegemony will diminish little by little, and how the people of the region themselves, the indigenous people, will take the initiative and will continue to achieve more and more steps towards sovereignty, independence, and liberation.
Well, Dr. Moussaoui, Iran definitely, the attack, the retaliatory attack against Zionist Israel, it reinforces its position amongst the anti-imperialist nations in the world, and it also definitely reassures the commitment of the Islamic Republic of Iran towards the Palestinian cause as a primary cause for Muslims around the world. But how might, do you think, that influence the regional alliances and the regional conflicts as well? I mean, Iran does have alliances in the region, but it does also have foes. How is that going to affect this relationship?
I believe it's all going to boil down to the Iranian interest. How? See what happened in the United States. Take the United States as one of the most influential superpowers in the world, like it or not, but this is a reality. Mm-hmm. Now, this is we're again under unipolar, but we have many other forces, regional forces coming out. The United States itself, that made very good calculations, they themselves don't want to go into a war with Iran. They want to have a regional stability. They know very well that any war against Iran, it's not going to boil down to their interest, and it's going to boost more and more the Iranian position in the region and in the West Asia position. That's why I believe, little by little, they are going to realize that more of those who are going to make their own realistic calculations about what's happening, they are going to be more convinced, to have good relations with Iran, and this is going to put Iran in a better position, will foster its achievements in the region, and it will make it a very important, pivotal, crucial force that many will come in order to have good relation with. One of the things that I want to talk about, the Iranian industry on the military level. Those who have always relied on America and on the American shield in order to protect themselves, they will know that Iran has been able to make a complete crash for this kind of propaganda that the American weapons are invincible and they can do their job. Iran, with its own capabilities, with the genius people who have made the industry and the inventions and the creativity solutions for many problems, have been able to go and to attack one of the highly fortified, highly militarized areas in the region. It's the Israeli entity with the support of America and the West. Now, this is something very important on the geopolitical level. Take Saudi Arabia, for example, that have taken a position of rapprochement with Iran. This is going to make Saudi Arabia more convinced about its decisions, about its choices. And this will push others who are going to make their realistic calculations that it's our interest to come and make a kind of relation, or at least not to go into a kind of a clash with Iran, at least to make into a kind of a relation to pacify the region. I believe we are going to yield a lot of results. Iran is going to yield a lot of results. The axis of resistance is going to yield a lot of positive results on the coming future.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Moussaoui, a lot of people who are truly ignorant, they don't know what Iran is and how Iran came to be the way that it is. They have no idea that the leadership of the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, and before him the success of the revolution at the hands of Imam Ruhollah Khomeini as well, were the main pillar that brought Iran to where it is right now as not only a regional but an international power. That has definitely shattered the credibility and the position of Zionist Israel across the world because of this leader that was adamant on showing the world that despite the sanctions, despite the animosity, Iran will continue and persist to stand by the Palestinian people and all the peoples in the region who are oppressed by imperialism and colonialism. How do you explain this leadership to the Western audience, and how did it really help in getting Iran here?
Well, since the advent of the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic of Iran, everybody thought that Iran is going to rely, for example, on the Soviet Union at the time, because we witnessed the collapse of Soviet Union later in the early 90s, 1989. The advent of America as the unipolar. Of course, there was this antagonistic, this animosity, this kind of severing of relation between America and the Islamic Republic of Iran after the revolution. Iran has put it very clearly. It's not going to rely on the East. It's not going to rely on the West. It's an Islamic Republic. And they started to depend on themselves. And all, just imagine this. I mean, this is incredible. It's all like a miracle within a miracle within a miracle. Iran, that has always been under siege, under the war, Saddam war, the imposed war for 8 years, the sanctions, the siege of against Iran, not allowing Iran to take any technology, not allowing Iran to sell its oil, not all of these that happened, the total siege against Iran, continuous conspiracies, attempt on the lives of the scientists, the nuclear scientists, and many of them were martyred, many of the leaders. Yet Iran comes to the world with these significant achievements. Iran, from the very beginning, with the resolve and the determination and this relying on Allah, the omnipotent, the omnipresence, this is the miracle of faith. This is the rejuvenating and the revivalism of Islamism and of the religion, the role of religion in the life of the people, that is ready to give all possible alternative against any challenges. Mm-hmm. This is the important thing that Iran has done under Imam Khomeini, under Imam Khamenei, and with this leadership, and with also the congregation and the support of the people towards this leadership. Mm-hmm. Iran, by itself, and with all of the siege and with all of the isolation and with all of the sanctions, has been able to make all of these achievements. Israel, with all of the support, with all of the supply, with all of the Western power coming, bringing arms to it, has not been able to defend itself. Mm-hmm. Just make this comparison, and it will tell you a lot about something that the ordinary people, not only the ordinary people, all those who believe in the theories of liberalism and mm-hmm. whatever, they should understand that we, the Muslims, believe that Allah is always there. Mm-hmm. Allah is the omnipotent. Allah is the omnipresent.
It's the power of faith.
And it's the power of faith.
And faith brings along miracles.
And the surrender to Allah's will and determination that His will prevail, mm-hmm. and the will of the believers of Allah will prevail, and all of those, the arrogance, the world arrogance, the colonizers, all of them will fail, inshallah.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, Hezbollah MP and Professor of Media Theories and Studies at the Lebanese University, thanks a million for being with us to discuss this unprecedented victory in the region, especially at the hands of the believers who we were talking about just right now. Thanks a million for being with us. Hopefully, us along with you, we will be able to see the liberated Al-Aqsa and the liberated oppressed people of Gaza as well, regaining their liberty and their dignity, inshallah, Azza wa Jal. Thanks a million for being with us. We promise to always give you the latest updates from right here, West Asia, on the Middle East Stream.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Evan Corcoran, a key attorney for Donald Trump, turned witness in the classified documents case against him, has left Trump's legal team. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. CNN Cable News Network has covered this story and tells us more. Evan Corcoran, an attorney for Donald Trump who became a critical witness in the classified document case against the former president, no longer represents him, according to a CNN report. According to multiple sources familiar with the matter, Evan Corcoran left Donald Trump's legal team in recent months, a notable departure as the criminal case remains in limbo in South Florida. Corcoran's quiet exit from Trump's orbit could pose a significant issue for the former president, with the potential for prosecutors to call him as a key witness if the case goes to trial. He was also one of the last attorneys on Donald Trump's defense team to have handled his federal investigations from the beginning, as his legal peril skyrocketed. Corcoran was brought on to help Trump fend off charges in the classified documents investigation, but instead turned into a central witness after Donald Trump allegedly misled him about the whereabouts of the documents at his Mar-a-Lago club and encouraged him to lie to the Justice Department and withhold those documents. 1 year ago, Evan Corcoran was required to appear before a grand jury investigating the case after a district judge ruled he could not use attorney-client privilege to shield notes and memos from investigators about his interactions with Donald Trump, saying that prosecutors met the threshold for the crime-fraud exception for him. The voice memos turned into notes provided a roadmap for prosecutors when they indicted Donald Trump. Corcoran is referred to as Trump Attorney 1 in that indictment. If the case goes to trial, Evan Corcoran will likely be a key witness for the prosecution. The case has been mired in delay and unresolved logistical questions for months now. Corcoran ultimately recused himself from representing Donald Trump in the classified documents case, but continued to represent him in other investigations. He personally accompanied the former president when he was arraigned in Washington last August on federal charges relating to his efforts to overturn the 2020 election. Trump campaign spokesman Stephen Chung told CNN in a statement, "Mr. Corcoran remains on the legal team and is continuing to help fighting the Biden trial witch hunts," adding that any assertion otherwise is fake news, peddled by uninformed sources and untruthful reporting that seeks to leak disinformation and misinformation. Evan Corcoran's departure from the team underscores how those who could ultimately take either of those cases to trial are relatively new to Trump's legal team. Two other attorneys who were working on those two probes, Jim Trusty and John Rowley, departed last summer. The result is a loss of institutional knowledge from attorneys who were in the throes of the investigations, dealing with subpoenas and communicating with Justice Department lawyers before they turned into historic indictments. But it is Evan Corcoran's role in the classified documents probe that could pose the biggest problem for Donald Trump. According to Special Counsel Jack Smith, Corcoran's memos detailed his interactions with Donald Trump and reveal how Corcoran's client was scheming to undermine the subpoena from prosecutors. At one point, after Corcoran had personally searched for remaining documents at Mar-a-Lago, Donald Trump discussed with the attorney what to do with 38 documents marked as classified that Corcoran had found and placed in a Redwell folder. "Did you find anything? Is it bad? Is it good?" Trump allegedly said, according to the indictment. The two discussed whether the attorney should bring the documents to his hotel room to keep them safe. Donald Trump then reportedly made a plucking motion during the conversation, which the Corcoran memorialized as meaning, "Okay, why don't you take them with you to your hotel room, and if there's anything really bad in there, you know, pluck it out." Brian Butler, a former Mar-a-Lago walker referenced as Trump employee number 5 in the classified documents indictment of Trump, also placed Corcoran at a key moment leading up to the former president's indictment. During an interview with CNN, Brian Butler recalled helping unknowingly to move boxes containing classified information to the airport at the same time Donald Trump was greeting federal investigators at his property in June of 2022. "I remember seeing this tall guy," Butler said, "who now I know to be Evan Corcoran, and I saw a bunch of other people in the living room. I had no clue. I'm just seeing all these people. I have no clue what they're there for." Brian Butler later realized it was a meeting that Corcoran and another attorney had with investigators from the FBI. 2 months later, the FBI descended upon Mar-a-Lago with a search warrant. The British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story. A longtime attorney for Donald Trump, who is expected to be a key witness in a criminal case targeting the former president's possession of classified documents at Mar-a-Lago, has reportedly left his legal team. Evan Corcoran, who recused himself from the Florida case last year, is no longer representing Donald Trump in any of his criminal and civil cases, according to a CNN report. Mr. Corcoran quickly found himself at the center of the classified documents case after he was hired to represent Donald Trump, who faces a 40-count indictment alleging violations of the Espionage Act, obstruction, and the illegal removal of federal records after he left the White House. His prolific notes and voice recordings that reportedly detail his exchanges with Donald Trump have become central to Special Counsel Jack Smith's prosecution, revealing how the former president allegedly misled his then-attorney about his mishandling of sensitive documents and attempts to evade a subpoena. Evan Corcoran ultimately stepped down from the case 1 year ago following his testimony to a federal grand jury, while his client tried and failed to block his communications by invoking attorney-client privilege. A ruling from a federal appeals court panel last year effectively forced Evan Corcoran to turn over the documents, including recordings of Donald Trump, to the grand jury. Despite his recusal from the case, Evan Corcoran later joined Donald Trump at a federal courthouse in Washington, D.C., when the former president was arraigned on charges connected to his scheme to overturn election results in 2020. The Independent has requested comment from Mr. Corcoran and a spokesman for the Donald Trump campaign. A statement from the Trump campaign spokesperson Stephen Cheung claims that Mr. Corcoran remains on Donald Trump's legal team. But the alleged departure of a key lawyer listed as Trump Attorney 1 in the Mar-a-Lago indictment could potentially pose a liability for the presumed Republican nominee for president as he battles four separate criminal cases in four jurisdictions, with his so-called hush money trial for allegedly falsifying business records due to begin on 15th of April. Evan Corcoran's detailed memos have provided prosecutors with evidence of an alleged scheme to undermine subpoenas from the U.S. Department of Justice, and Donald Trump's own apparent request to get rid of potentially damning evidence in his possession. At one point after Mr. Corcoran performed a search of Mar-a-Lago, Donald Trump appeared to ask him if he found anything incriminating among a cache of 38 documents and suggested he pluck them out, according to prosecutors.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another additional program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Chowdhury, guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me on this talk.
Well, we are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to enjoining the good and forbidding the evil. With Sheikh Javid, let me ask you, Sheikh, this question. With regard to enjoining the good and forbidding evil, should individuals can find themselves to the oral level of enjoining and forbidding, limiting the obligation to oral reminding contradicts with what is stated in the books on practical laws and Islam, of Islam, particularly the Tahrul Wasila. And if they are allowed, when necessary, to advance to other grades, will it be permissible for them at times of necessity to carry out all the graded levels mentioned in the Book of Tahrir al-Wasila?
From what you ask, I understand, and of course, based on what the scholars have stated, there are different grades of Amr bil Ma'ruf and Nahi anil Munkar.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you cannot go to the second and then third grade,
yes,
or third grade.
Mm-hmm.
You have to stick to the first grade when it is effective. Like, for example, oral enjoining is okay as long as it has the necessary impact.
Right.
But if it if you think you will need to go to the second grade of enjoining the good and forbidding evil, you have to do it when the first grade is not sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
So according to the fatwa of His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, considering that under the Islamic government, the grades, I'm reading the fatwa from the Ajwibatul Istifta'at, because I have to quote, cite actually the hymn from his book. He says that considering that under an Islamic government, the grades subsequent to all enjoining the good and forbidding evil are delegated to security and judicial authorities,
mm-hmm,
particularly with respect to cases where prevention of evil entails exertion of force, handling the assets of the wrongdoer, exercising ta'zir, you know, ta'zir means discretionary punishment against such individual, and his detention and the like, it is obligatory for the mukallaf, for the duty-bound person, to confine himself to oral enjoining and forbidding, and to oral forbidding.
Mm-hmm.
And when the need arises for the use of force,
right,
it's necessary to refer the case to the police and judicial authorities, His Eminence Ayatollah Khamenei says. So this does not contradict the fatwa of the late Imam Khomeini, may his soul rest in peace, in this regard. There's no contradiction.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, as we discussed in one of the previous episodes, it's not permissible for an individual to take the law into his own hands and to exercise it.
Yes.
Because otherwise,
society will be chaotic.
Chaotic. There will be chaos, and chaos and lawlessness is a fitna which does not, with Islam, which Islam does not allow.
Thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Sawid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to enjoining the good and forbidding the evil. Sheikh Sawid, before the break, I asked you the question regarding enjoining the good and forbidding the evil, especially with respect to the grades, or the graded levels of this, right, mentioned in the Book of Tahrir al-Wasila. But would you talk a little about grades? What do we mean by grades, or the graded levels? You talked about the conditions and limitations of enjoining the good and forbidding the evil. But what about the grades? I think this is an important concept we need to pause on a little.
On grades, you know, it's a kind of, there is gradation. Gradation means, okay, you have to start from the very soft approach to a harder, you know, stance.
Mm.
Like, for example, getting a little bit angry, talking to him to convince him to turn off, for yes. example, to not do something.
Mm. You mean to show it in verbally?
Yeah, verbally and talking orally to convince someone yes. not to do something. This is the first, you know, phase or grade. And then if he does not do it, for example, if he's listening to music, you can jump into action and turn off the tape recorder or right. let's say the player. That's the physical action. Mm-hmm. You if that's not possible, maybe you will have to I just give the example of listening to music, but right. there are other examples, like if someone is about to kill someone, okay, and you can prevent him from killing him, you need to take action, immediate action, to stop him from killing him. Mm-hmm. So that's even you will need a harder action to take to stop that individual from killing another individual, which is a grave sin.
Mm.
So these are the grades, okay?
I see.
One should start with the softer approach.
Let's pick up from the example you gave regarding music. If
yes.
One is a passenger, like a client on, let's say, a bus, an airplane, on a ship or train, or even a taxi, and the bus driver or the taxi driver, in fact, plays the music. What is our duty as a passenger? Should we actually complain to the driver and tell him to turn it off?
Well, if the conditions for forbidding, let's say, the evil exist, in some cases it might exist, and sometimes the condition may not exist, and it may not be good to advise someone to turn off, because he will take offense and will jump, out of his car and will actually react harshly.
Mm-hmm.
So when the condition is fulfilled, you need to enjoin him orally, and you're not supposed to do anything further than that. And oral enjoining is sufficient. In case this forbidding is actually not effective,
mm-hmm.
it is obligatory to avoid listening to unlawful music, because you are sitting in the back of the car. You can choose not to listen, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, when it comes to just hearing, we have to differentiate between listening and hearing. We should not listen to music, but when you hear, you are not to blame. You mm-hmm. are hearing it and you don't want to hear, okay?
Yes.
You don't want to hear it, but okay, it's not within your control. You cannot mm-hmm. control it. You mm-hmm. cannot do anything about it.
It means that you cannot listen. Of course, you can hear, but don't yes. focus on it.
It's the same. The same is the case with right. going to a wedding hall, okay?
Mm.
There are lots of people, and maybe it's your brother's wedding. Wedding.
Yes.
You go there, you sit in the wedding hall, and there is music being played, but you don't enjoy listening to it, because you don't listen to it. Okay, but you do hear the mm-hmm. the music being played.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program on IRIB English Radio, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Don't go away.
Allahumma salli ala Sayyidina wa Nabiyina Muhammadin wa Ali.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to enjoining the good and forbidding the evil. Sheikh Javid, before the break, you talked about how we can encounter a situation like in a bus or in a taxi where the sound of music, is actually bothering you. Well, what about the sound of music or any kind of, noises and sounds which are generated by your neighbors, for example? If it is so high that it's bothersome and it becomes a bit of a nuisance for you, what can you do as a neighbor?
Well, it's haram to break into your neighbor's house
mm-hmm.
and stop him, okay? You can just ring the bell and tell him off, tell him not to play the music so loudly to yes. hurt the neighbor. If he or she doesn't seem to listen to you,
yes.
you are not authorized to take any further action, okay?
Yes.
You can actually, in such cases, you can call the police and say that, okay, your neighboring is creating, disturbing you, not allowing you to have sleep mm-hmm. or, you know, have rest. So, but you personally cannot take action in other than orally forbidding someone,
mm-hmm.
Your neighbor.
I see. But how about the spouses or close friends and relationships and relations, basically, you know, and what becomes of their duty if one finds that, for example, his spouse, his husband or her husband or his wife actually don't pay zakat or khums?
Well, again, you know, according to the religious authorities, as far as I have, I know, and I've read their risala, they have said that it is the duty of the child, for example, or the wife, to tell. For example, the wife should tell her husband to give khums of his asset, of his yes. property. Because both of them are going to use the same asset and both of them will have to, at the end of the day, use the money that the husband brings home
mm-hmm.
To buy bread, to buy clothing and other regular expenses, of course. So the wife can simply tell her husband to bring halal food, halal money to the family. If he does not listen to mm-hmm. his wife and continues like going to the casino, playing gambling and doing haram things, of course, as far as the wife is concerned, it is halal for the wife to use whatever the husband brings home. She cannot do anything about it because mm-hmm. she cannot say, okay, whatever you bring home is haram for me. I
yes.
cannot mm-hmm. spend it.
Yes.
Well, according to the religious authorities, maybe one out of four, maybe one out of three portions of the food and the money he brings home is halal. So he can consider that portion as the portion that halal, the money that is given to her as the halal portion of,
yes.
of his income, of
or
the
ration.
Yeah, and then use it, and there's no objection to the wife and also the children, because
mm-hmm.
the children are also helpless in that situation.
Yes.
So there's no problem in using the money, even if there is a very strong likelihood
yes.
that the money brought home is probably haram. But that doesn't mean that it's haram for the children and the wife as well.
I appreciate it, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, in which we try to deal with some of the jurisprudential laws related to enjoining the good and forbidding the evil. Thank you. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.